The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's program, we hear from Ted Nelson, one of the web's more colorful founding fathers, about his vision of the future.
As the world has evolved, I've gotten more and more indignant as it veered away from my original vision, which I still continue to attempt.
And Charles Arthur finds out about a technology that's bucking all of the economic trends.
October, November, and December, we were the UK's number one brand for soundbars, both by number of units sold and by value of units sold. So it was just a great year for us.
That was John Cameron from Orbit Sound there, and before that was Ted Nelson. Expect more on them and the latest headlines on this episode of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. A common problem with flat-screen TVs is that they sound more like transistor radios. One solution, if you're not keen on a multitude of speakers cluttering up your living room, is the home cinema soundbar. Orbit Sound are a UK company that have been winning plaudits for their T12 soundbar and iPod and iPhone speaker dock, which aims to stand out from its rivals by offering spatial sound as opposed to regular surround sound, which means that you don't have to sit in a particular part of the room to get the best sound. Charles Arthur spoke with Orbit Sound's chief operating officer, John Cameron, about the world of soundbars and asked him how the last year has been for Orbit Sound.
It was really a fantastic year for us. It's been a bit of a whirlwind, to be honest. We had a really good time at CES. We got some very good coverage. We had a prototype product, the T14.
Describe what the T14 does or did.
The T14 is a large soundbar that has a separate dock for iPhone or iPod. It had the capability of being wall-mounted. It had a wireless subwoofer, and it's just generally bigger, better, more powerful than our current flagship product, the T12. We showed the T14 as a prototype at CES and got fantastic coverage off that, a lot of press coverage. Generally, there was a very good reaction, so we were thrilled with that. And we had very strong sales through 2011, culminating in a fantastic final quarter where October, November, and December, we were the UK's number one brand for soundbars, both by number of units sold and by value of units sold. So it was just a great year for us.
Is that a very competitive market, the soundbar market? I've got to say, it's not one I was that familiar with.
It's a highly competitive market. All the major brands that make TVs all have their own soundbars. Plainly, there's an attraction for the consumer in buying a soundbar that matches the brand of TV which they've bought. The great advantage I think we have over most of these brands is just that we are an audio technology company. Sound quality is what we're all about, and you know, we're absolutely focused on sound quality. So for some of the other companies, a soundbar is very much an ancillary product or a tertiary product. It's not really what they're focused on, whereas for us, it's got our entire focus. It's what we're all about, and I think that comes out when you hear the product.
Now, a lot of people have been saying that the retail market has been very tough. You know, retailers, electrical retailers such as Currys and Dixons have been having a very tough time of it. Is that your experience? I mean, you said that you were doing well in October, November, December in the soundbar market, but generally, you know, people are saying it's a tough market out there.
I think it is a very tough market, and we work very closely with our retail partners, so we understand the challenges they face. The consumer isn't awash with cash at the moment. And generally, I think for obvious reasons, retailers are not running with huge amounts of inventory at the moment.
And you weren't at CES this year. And I did look around, but I couldn't find you. So why was that?
We thought very long and hard about it because we'd had four fantastic years at CES beforehand. And every year we'd done CES, something great had happened, whether it was being shortlisted by the UKTI as being one of the top two UK technology companies with potential for international growth, which I think was in 2010, or being invited to the Disney Best of CES show in 2008. For 2012, we just didn't have a product ready to launch at CES, and much as it's a great networking opportunity and you get to meet everyone who's anyone at CES, we thought resources, our limited resources, because we're a small company, we're better focused on consolidating what we're doing in the UK market, making sure we're serving our customers well in the UK market, and also continuing to focus on developing the new products which we've got in the pipeline. A few of us are flying out to China later this week to go and work closely with our factory out in Shenzhen. So that's where our focus is at the moment, with the new products at the factory and with continuing to give as much support as we can to our retail partners.
You mentioned Shenzhen and the factory out there. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism recently in newspapers about practices in factories. Apple has come in for criticism for the experiences of its workers. How do you guarantee the safe lives of the workers at the factories?
I think it's a very good question. And we switched factories back in September 2010. And we moved to a very high-quality factory in Shenzhen called 3Nord. We started working with 3Nord at the end of a quite detailed procurement process, which we undertook. We had a list of probably about 30 factories across China, which were either factories other people in the business had recommended to us or were factories that we'd worked with beforehand. We cut that down to a short list of 10 factories and went physically to see each factory at least twice. So we had two separate visits. Whilst I don't think you can ever guarantee there's not things going on that you don't know about, I mean, we did go and see the factory several times. We visit very regularly through the year. We sort of tour around the shop floors. We see the workers. And so I think we can be as confident as is possible to be that the factory we're working with does treat its staff very well. And we're actually friends with the management of the factory we work with. It's not just a sort of completely arm's length dispassionate relationship. So we trust our partners in China.
And back in the UK, with all the pressure on retail outlets, you know, such as Currys and Dixons and so on, how important is the high street to you to get things, you know, in front of people?
For us, the high street is absolutely critical. We do sell online. We sell reasonable numbers online. But the critical part of our sales really is in high street stores. And I think that's down to the fact that if someone's spending £299 for a product, they want to touch it, see it, feel it, and most importantly of all, hear it. And wherever possible, we want our customers to have the opportunity to hear the product. That's critical for us because we are all about the sound quality, and that's very difficult to convey online or in a TV or radio advert. The best sales method for us is just to demonstrate the product and for customers to have the chance to hear it.
Orbit Sound's John Cameron speaking with Charles Arthur. Now for this week's news.
The Home Affairs Select Committee published a report this week into the roots of violent radicalisation, citing the internet as the greatest vehicle for fostering real-world hate. Under review since May 2011, the committee recommends more government pressure on ISPs to take down sites that serve illegal or extremist material. The hacker collective Anonymous has released an audio recording of a conversation between the FBI and Scotland Yard, exposing details of an international cybercrime investigation. The organisations have admitted the breach and are currently investigating the issue. Virgin Media this week announced that it will be rolling out its superfast broadband service to the UK ahead of schedule, bringing speeds of up to 120 megabytes into homes around the country as early as this spring. This news came 1 week after the announcement that the company would be increasing its rates by an average of £25 per year, despite a promise to roll out the superfast service at the same price.
Thanks. You can read more on these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Ted Nelson is one of the pioneers of the web. He coined the terms hypertext and hypermedia in 1963, and way back in 1960, he founded Project Xanadu. with the goal of creating a computer network with a simple user interface. Xanadu was supposed to be the universal, democratic hypertext library that would help human life evolve into a completely new form. But it's failed to take off. And he's currently working on a new information structure, ZigZag, and has developed Xanadu Space, a system for the exploration of connected parallel documents. I spoke with him at the Oxford Internet Institute's Decade in Internet Time event last year.
I had a vision in 1960 of worldwide publishing by individuals for individuals without the intermediation of publishers, and of the personal computer as a new way of life. I envisioned all human work as migrating to the computer screen. And as the world has evolved, I've gotten more and more indignant as it veered away from my original vision, which I still continue to attempt to implement.
Now, the project that you've been working on for a while is Project Xanadu. Yep. So tell me about the origins of Project Xanadu.
Well, the name, of course, comes from the Coleridge poem, which, of course, was a poem about the original Xanadu, which is actually a place about 300 kilometers north of Beijing, which was the summer palace of the Emperor Kublai Khan, as described by Marco Polo. Then Coleridge read the Marco Polo stuff and, in an opiate trance, apparently, wrote Kublai Khan, and that is considered the most romantic poem in the English language. And then he was interrupted, he says, in his reveries and in writing down his poem by a person from Porlock who made him forget. And so to me, this name symbolized the magic place of literary memory where nothing would be forgotten, and so I've stuck with it.
I like that, but now it's evolved.
Oh, yeah, well, but it's really had the same form since 1979 when I got together with a very brilliant team of eccentric geniuses, and we essentially worked out the structure, and we were so far ahead that we worked out elaborate optimizations. Now, one of the rules of the computer world is premature optimization is very dangerous because you don't know what part you should optimize. And so we got lost in brilliant technicalities, and then we got backing, and then another team got lost in other brilliant technicalities, and by then it was 1992 and they'd wasted $5 million and I had no say over it. So I got the name back and have been endeavoring since 1992 to bring forth a much simpler version that will work in today's systems.
Now, given that you have been working in the computing industry for such a long time and you've seen projects come and go, you've had your own ups and downs with projects, can you offer advice to any developers to
yes.
say avoid or do?
First of all, learn to program. Drop everything and spend several years actually learning to program. Do not be distracted by false hopes and doing it some other way, because the only way to get creative control in this field, the issue is just like Hollywood, the issue is creative control. And everybody wants to take it in a different direction. So if you have something you want to do, do it yourself.
You mentioned the origins of Xanadu, and that's quite an ideological
yep.
approach. So I'm assuming that you embrace the idea that Xanadu itself has an ideology that you are imposing or you are imbuing your project with?
It certainly embodies a paradigm, the notion being, very much in consonance with the World Wide Web, that everybody can publish and everybody can... you have authors and publishers who can be the same people. The difference is quotability. So Xanadu emphasizes that you're building from formerly existent pieces, if you want to. And so quotations remain connected to their origin so that every context, every previous context can be seen, or rather the original context of every quote can be seen. And so that... So that is intended to help not just for scholarship, but for example, for managing large projects, the refactoring of complex documents, trying to correlate thousands of pieces. And the best way to do that is when you take a piece out of context, have that original context available, because it's so often, or let's say one time out of 20, you really want to know where the thing came from, and there's no way in today's environment.
This is a system in which it's a transparent system mm-hmm. in which you can see the context, that which has come before. Can you imagine a political system or another area where this may not be the best approach to create a system?
Well, I think that a lot of people, politics would certainly benefit from it, because people can say, I was misquoted, and there's the original context. So you can see whether or not they were misquoted, whether it fits whether the phrase was taken out of context. And similarly, you can see what the origins of things are and as things move along, and a lot of people don't want that known.
That ultimately is the problem, isn't it? And so I suppose there's an element of imperialism with the technology if you seek it to diffuse and go beyond.
I wouldn't use those words, particular word like imperialism, so much as sort of stubbornness. and look, what I'm giving you is good enough. You don't need anything more. And I'm coming from a literary background and saying, look, you want to know as much as possible. And if that's an ideology, fine, so be it, because I want to facilitate human understanding in every possible way.
You spoke this evening about we are limited by our pasts. We keep trying to recreate virtually, digitally, things like pieces of paper or desks, and that's just, it's a stupid and silly way to do it. And yet we're embedded in and entrenched in those because... You know, here we are. We are embedded and entrenched in them. We've been using these practices for such a long time. They themselves have an ideology. They themselves have particular affordances and restrictions. Can you imagine developing a system? You postulated this. You proposed this for us to open up our imaginations and, you know, approach development in some ways with imagination. Can you imagine a system in which there was no ideology embedded into it?
Let's put it this way. Ideology is a tricky term. The frame of reference of the developers is really the thing, because it's not as though Rupert Murdoch said let's make a conservative piece of software. It's as though the people said no. All what you want is paper simulation. That's not exactly an ideology in the old form, and that's what's behind Microsoft Word and Adobe Acrobat and the World Wide Web, and so there's no ideology behind Microsoft Windows. They simply took an old operating system and kept putting diapers on it until it tried to make it acceptable, and it just gets worse and worse, and the Macintosh gets stranger and stranger, but they're still just polishing the same structure. And it wasn't ideological, it was convenient.
To what extent within Project Xanadu is there a flexibility for what happens after people get their hands on it and it becomes a social technology?
Well, I think we invented wikis and blogs and all of these things beforehand, but everybody else is doing those additional features so that commentary and wikis and blogs aren't really compatible, and they're not going to be either, whereas it's all built into Xanadu. You just simply pass the wand and say, okay, right now you get to make these changes, but we'll see who made them, and if that if somebody wants that information, it's there.
That was Ted Nelson speaking with me last year. Now, what do you think? Send your thoughts to techweekly@guardian.co.uk or comment on our Facebook page. That's it for this week's podcast. And if you want to get in touch, head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all the social and the anti-social options, including our links to our Facebook page, our Twitter page, and our email address. The producer this week was Simon Barnard. I'm Alex Kratowski. We are back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.